it's a very valid and feasible investment market, but it's counterintuitive to what many people assume would be an investment environment in more Western countries or even in other Asian countries. So, for example, people in the States or in Australia, New Zealand, the UK, kind of purchase with the assumption that property will gain value over time if they hold on to it over an extended period of time, or they might try to time a particular peak in a particular local market. And the investment is done with the concept of incrementally leveraging on that extra equity down the track, then selling at a profit. Those things, while they can happen here, are a lot less predictable than they would be in other markets. So in the last 12, 13 years, we've had growth in major metropolitan centers and recently even in rural areas, but that's on the back of 25 years of deflation where property prices were almost half of what they were in the early 90s or late 80s, right? So it could happen, but we wouldn't advise to our customers to bank on that as any given criteria in their selection of properties. If you buy a central Tokyo property, it could potentially gain value. It has been gaining in value for the last few years, but your cash flow will be very, very low. And then if that rise in price doesn't occur, then you could have been either negatively geared or very close to zero over a period of, let's say, 10 years. This is a cash flow oriented market.
Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right. Welcome back, everyone, and a belated Happy New Year to you. Trust you've had a restful holiday season. I know I have. Welcome to the very first Japan Real Estate Podcast episode of 2025. I honestly can't believe how long I've been doing this. We published our very first episode back in September 2017. So over 7 years and hundreds of episodes, this one is episode 326. Imagine that, which means that we've been very consistently publishing an average of one weekly episode, barring these holiday seasons, of course, every year for more than 7 years. I honestly never imagined I'd be able to keep it this consistent. And to be perfectly honest, the only reason I've been able to continue doing this is your feedback, which has always been overwhelmingly positive. So huge thank you for your patronage so far. Also, a lot of you have been asking how you could express your gratitude, which is very kind of you. So I've just set up a buymeacoffee.com account, which you can find on buymeacoffee.com/ZMagen. That's ZMAGEN. I'll also link to it in the show notes from here on and mention it here from time to time. Don't be shy to drop by and show your appreciation, but also please don't feel obliged to. I promise to always provide you with the same level of value and appreciation for free as I've been doing so far. But if you do want to buy me a coffee or a shot of premium whiskey, depending on the size of the donation, I'll never say no to that, of course. Thank you in advance for those who choose to do so. Okay, so for today's episode, this is a conversation that I've recently had with Mr. Sean McBride, who some of you may already know. He's an Australian gentleman who's married to a Japanese national,
And he's got a keen interest in Japanese real estate, which he's been exploring for quite some time. We've been in touch for quite some time as well. He's recently set up a YouTube channel, which has been quite popular, particularly with folks interested in the market here, mainly focusing on Akiya and holiday homes or lifestyle properties, as he calls them. But also, he's got quite an interest in investment properties here in Japan. And he asked me if I could come on his channel and have a chat about the market in general, but also on quite a few specific topics. And so we discuss how to buy real estate properties in Japan, the challenges facing foreigners, and particularly non-resident foreigners who are buying here, the gap between official government policies, which are quite welcoming legally, as opposed to the boots-on-the-ground logistics of actually making it happen, Japanese bureaucracy, everything that's involved in that. We also discuss why and who should be investing in Japan, and more importantly, who shouldn't be investing in Japan, the major and minor differences between the property investment market here as opposed to other countries, how cheaply one can buy into the market here for both investment and holiday or family homes, should folks be visiting Japan before or during the purchase process itself, how to work with Japanese realtors, and of course also about the services that we provide, how much they cost, who could benefit from them. We also discussed due diligence and what that looks like for various property profiles and categories, the huge culture and language gap, how to manage properties remotely for those who, like most of our clients, don't actually reside in Japan. And we also talk specifically about buying Akiyas, what buyers should be aware of before pursuing those properties, how to search for them, Japan's demographics, and how those might affect investment decisions. And finally, a bit of a deep dive on condos or mansions in more detail. What are they all about? What are they good for? What our tenant base might look like? Where to purchase and what features to look for in these investment properties? And much, much more. So a very thorough conversation on all aspects of the property market here. Hope you'll enjoy it. And then at the end of it, I've also attached another shorter segment of a more personal nature that may or may not hold interest for you. I'll tell you all about it at the end of this first conversation, and you can then decide if you'd like to carry on listening or skip ahead. I will definitely not be offended. But first, as promised, my conversation with Sean McBride.
I know that the idea of buying Japanese real estate can seem intimidating, especially if you don't speak Japanese. So today, I want to introduce Ziv Nakajima-Magan as my first guest to help ease your way into the sometimes confusing Japanese real estate market. Ziv is co-founder of Nippon Tradings International, a buyer's agency and portfolio management firm based in Japan that helps take the confusion out of buying Japanese real estate for foreign nationals, such as people like myself. Now, Ziv and I have been communicating over the past year, and he's been extremely helpful and patient in cutting through my misconceptions about Japanese property, for which I am very grateful. Welcome, Ziv, and thanks for taking the time today.
Pleasure. I'm admiring your work, actually. I've been looking at your, checking out your journey on YouTube, and it's fascinating. It's fascinating to see you being fascinated by stuff.
Ah, thank you. Thank you. And look, I'm a novice, even though I've been here a number of times. You know, I'm still a novice when it comes to Japan. I don't speak the language much yet, only a little bit. And you've been here for, how long have you been here now?
Just going on 12 years now.
12 years. Well, you can do a lot in 12 years, as I've seen from looking at your stuff. You've set up a pretty impressive organization. The thing about Japan is that unlike some Asian countries, there's no issues for foreigners to buy properties in Japan. Which is great.
Legally.
So given that there's no issue with that, firstly, Ziv, what do you think is the biggest obstacle to a foreigner in buying property in Japan?
Well, it's like a lot of things in Japan. There's this gap, chasm, I would say, between official legal slash national government policy and then boots on the ground practicality and logistics. So, like you mentioned, there's no legal barrier for anyone who wants to purchase property in Japan. There's no extra taxes. They're not limited certain types of properties. They're actually the only country in Asia Pacific that doesn't have any of these limitations. Right. But the banks won't let you open a bank account. The real estate agents are terrified of working with you for fear of misunderstandings. Landlords don't want to rent to you, not even in a case of a purchase, but even renting is very difficult, often even more difficult. You get over to a lawyer's office or a legal affairs bureau to handle the ownership transfers, any government agency. It's very rare that anyone would actually be able to communicate with you in English. Documentation, would be in Japanese. And while you're legally allowed to buy the property, you're not legally allowed to sign documents that you can't read. So there are all of these little, smaller and bigger hurdles that you have to navigate through to actually practically, logistically manage a purchase and then management of a property here.
Okay. I have come across that myself. And even my wife, who's Japanese, has had dramas trying to open a bank account here because we're just back in the country after many years. And that was a long, tedious process as well. So everything is very bureaucratic. I mentioned in my last video, I think, that you can open a bank account here, but you really have to be a resident. You can't just be a foreign national, can you?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So as you know from our discussions, my interest in Japanese property revolves more around lifestyle rather than investment. But I think many people would like to know whether Japanese property is also an investment opportunity. What's your feeling on that?
It's definitely an investment opportunity. Our company has been around for about 13 years now, almost 14. And at the start, I'd say about half of that time, all we were doing was investment properties. So we initially started our journey by purchasing investment properties for ourselves and then figuring out that people could use help with the process, started to market our services to other people. Until the Akiya boom and until we started getting more and more inquiries about, like yourself, about people interested in holiday homes or family residences or short-term stays, we haven't actually done any of that. So before we even started with holiday homes, we already had a couple of hundred of investment property purchases under our belt. So it's a very valid and feasible investment market, but it's counterintuitive to what many people assume would be an investment environment in more Western countries or even in other Asian countries. So, for example, people in the States or in Australia, New Zealand, the UK, kind of purchase with the assumption that property will gain value over time if they hold on to it over an extended period of time, or they might try to time a particular peak in a particular local market. And the investment is done with the concept of incrementally leveraging on that extra equity down the track, then selling at a profit. Those things, while they can happen here, are a lot less predictable than they would be in other markets. So in the last 12, 13 years, we've had growth in major metropolitan centers and recently even in rural areas, but that's on the back of 25 years of deflation where property prices were almost half of what they were in the early 90s or late 80s, right? So it could happen, but we wouldn't advise to our customers to bank on that as any given criteria in the selection of properties. If you buy a central Tokyo property, it could potentially gain value. It has been gaining in value for the last few years, but your cash flow will be very, very low. And then if that rise in price doesn't occur, then you could have been either negatively geared or very close to zero over a period of, let's say, 10 years. This is a cash flow oriented market compared to other Western or, let's say, developed countries. The cash flow here is relatively high in relatively good locations. The other attraction of this market is that even now, after these last 12, 13 years of growth in many places, there are still many, many places in Japan that are good tenancy markets, but are still very affordable. So that affordability also translates into diversity, into hedging, right? For the price of a single asset overseas, you can buy four or five of them here, all sure. of them generating income. If one tenant moves out, you've lost 20, 25% of your income stream, not the entire income stream like you would if you owned a single asset. So the affordability enables people to enter the market at a lower level and also enables people with a higher budget to diversify more. And that translates into geographic diversity over the country, socioeconomic, different types of tenants, different types of properties, a lot of things that you can do with that. And I think the third attraction to this particular investment environment is that it's very headache and hassle free. So you've mentioned the bureaucracy and everything being done in a certain way here. That also translates into a lot of peace of mind. So everything has got paper trail to the moon and back. The professional companies and that you work with here in Japan are, I mean, they might be more or less professional in what they do, but they're never going to have their hand in your pocket, or you don't need to be concerned that they'll, you know, declare bankruptcy and run for the hills with your money. That those sort of things don't really happen here. It's a very legal recourse kind of well-documented, well-monitored and controlled environment, which appeals to people like me. It doesn't appeal to other people, obviously.
Sure.
And the tenants as well are very hassle-free. They like to stay in the same place for as long as they can. They prefer for nothing to change. They're not going to trouble you with constant requests and complaints and you know, cause damage to properties, drug labs, ghettos, you know, looters, squatters, those kinds of things don't really happen here.
Right.
So that enables, again, people who are that way inclined, it's not everyone, but myself, for example, I like to set and forget, right? I like to complete a deal, put it in place, know that the income is coming in regularly. I don't need to worry about it and move on to the next deal. And I can do that here. In other countries, I constantly have to be tweaking and monitoring and making sure that no one's, you know, doing anything that they shouldn't be doing with the property. It's just hassle-free, headache-free market. So from those aspects and others, we can discuss that, you know, to the moon and back, but it's a very attractive investment environment for people who are interested in those aspects. If you're looking for a quick deal, money to be made over 3, 4 years, exploding, borrowing again against your equity, you know, creative finance, that's not a market for that, right?
And I like that. And you know how crazy the prices are in the Australian real estate market at the moment. You know, in my hometown, and I mean, you lived in the Gold Coast. My hometown is Brisbane. The median house price there is 925,000 Australian dollars, which is just over
I've read that.
600,000 US. Now, let's say I wanted to buy a property in
That
Japan.
buys me, I gotta point out, that buys me a couple of small buildings, you know, 4 to 8 units
I
in
know,
good
it's
location,
great. It's
suburban
crazy.
metro center.
And that brings up my point. And let's say I wanted to buy a property in Japan. What in terms of say from an investment point of view, like apartments, that kind of thing, what do you feel is the lowest price that someone could expect to start with to get into the Japanese housing market?
Well, practically, there are still some, you know, older studio type units available in suburban locations in reasonable cities, not the top tier, maybe second tier or third tier cities that are still, you know, have got good population and employment fundamentals, but do not stand to grow in value that much. The tenant profile would be lower, you know, lower income earners, convenience store workers, entry-level salarymen, retired semi-destitute pensioners, that kind of thing. Those in those types of locations, those profiles of properties, you can still purchase for as low as, I'd say, 20, 30,000 US.
Okay, that's a big difference from American Australian property, which would be 10, 15 times more than that, I suppose.
Yeah, 100 and 150 is usually where they would start, wouldn't be below most cases. But those are not the best profile properties and best profile tenants. So they stand to lose value a lot quicker because they're older and less central. And the tenants, again, it's Japan. They're not going to be criminals, but they would potentially occasionally, you know, have to terminate mid-lease because they can't afford the rent, or they would have few delays or late payments or missing payments. You might have to kick them out, which again, all of these things are not a big deal in Japan. It's easily doable, but it does take from your mental bandwidth, and it does eventually create a fluctuating yield because, you know, you got a longer vacancy suddenly in the middle. You have to pay some extra expenses that you weren't banking on, so it's not as stable and as nice of an investment. I would say to practically get something that would, you know, comply with all of those attractive features mentioned before, I would probably start at about 5, 6 million yen. So in Australian dollar terms, that's what, 50, about 50, 60,000, maybe 45, 50 US.
Still, that's way ahead of anything in Australia or America at the moment.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens, and they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
Given that, what would you recommend as a first step if someone doesn't speak Japanese and they wanted to invest in Japan? Invest or buy a property for a lifestyle, either way.
Well, I mean, I would educate them yourself a little bit at least first. I would get in touch with a foreigner-friendly agent who would service you in English with English documentation, English explanations, be able to handle the purchase remotely because you don't want to come here for every signing meeting and every little payment of funds that you need to. But the due diligence, the stuff that you need to educate yourself on are quite different, whether if it's an investment property versus a holiday home. And the realtors in Japan are, again, they're by the book. They're very polite and professional, and they're not going to swindle you. But they are realtors. They're transaction-oriented. So they're not going to tell you, in most cases, there are some rarities, but most of them will not tell you what questions you want to be asking. They're not going to prioritize one listing over another for you and point out the features. In some cases, they will a little bit, but they're not there to make sure you get the best deal for your money. They're there to help you conclude a particular transaction, either that they've researched for you or that you've provided them with a listing yourself, right? So it's not a bad idea to have someone on your side, either a friend or a colleague or a family member who's done this before, at least a little bit familiar with, you know, the things you want might want to look at. Mm-hmm. Or if you don't have anyone like that, maybe hire someone like us. Or I would say to get over the language and cultural barrier, you can hire pretty much anyone who speaks polite Japanese, right? You can hire an exchange student who's worked in a Japanese company for even a month or two. They know how to speak politely and introduce you and help you purchase logistically. Right. But it's a good idea because, again, the market here can be a bit counterintuitive to what you'd expect in other markets. The things that you want to look out for might be a little bit different, and we can talk about that for days on end, but it's a good idea to have someone on your side who knows what they're doing just to help you avoid costly mistakes and select the right kind of property for your criteria.
That's a good lead into my next question, which is, on your website, you describe yourself as a one-stop shop. Now, what do you mean by that?
Our service is beneficial to buyers on two fronts. So we're just focusing on the buying process now. We can talk about the management later. But for the purchase process itself, one is, again, the expertise and making sure that you're not making any costly mistakes, reviewing documents before anyone signs them to make sure there's no hidden surprises in there, conducting the right due diligence on the building if it's a condo that you're buying, or on the house or the building that if it's an entire structure that you're buying, structural inspection. So we make sure you do everything right. The other advantage of hiring someone like us is that we'll give the Japanese side a Japanese face to work with. So whereas if a foreigner on their own, especially one who doesn't reside here and or doesn't speak, read, write Japanese, when we contact Japanese real estate agents, again, we run into, in particular locations like Central Tokyo, Niseko up in Hokkaido, maybe a handful of agents in Osaka, a couple in Fukuoka. There are agents who are able to service foreigners directly in English. But that gives you, depending on which agency you contacted, that might give you access to the particular properties that they're interested in selling or that they're listing themselves. You're going to be limited in your ability to access the entire market if you only have to focus on working with those people who can service you directly in English. So a company like ours gives you the advantage of opening up not the entire market, because there's still always be 10-15% who don't want to work with anyone, even if there's a foreigner at the far end of it. But in most cases, we are able to, you know, convince everyone involved that they don't need to worry about, they never have to speak to the scary foreigner at the other end. Everything will be done in Japanese the way that they're used to. We've got a power of attorney document enabling us to sign all the documents, attend all the meetings on the scary foreigner's behalf. And that just opens up the market for with other agencies that would normally be foreigner shy.
So let's say that someone did buy a property through you and lives in America or Australia or elsewhere. They don't have residency here. How do they manage the property from afar?
That's, again, a service that we can provide. So if it's a short-term stay management, for example, if you get a property that you're renting out on Airbnb, a lot of those companies do have English speakers in-house. They cater to foreign guests, obviously, and they would be able to also cater to you as a landlord. But in most other cases, if you're just purchasing a home for your own personal use, or you're renting an investment property out long-term or by the month, in those cases, again, the management companies are usually not going to be able to service you in English and definitely not going to be able to handle remote transactions of funds overseas. They've just never done it. They don't know how to do it and they're not interested in learning. So we can provide the management service on your behalf. So same as we would have done with the purchase, we are in contact with local real estate agents, local management companies, local owner unions, insurance companies. We would do the same thing by collecting your income into our own bank accounts, because you can't open a bank account, providing you with an annual statement of income and expenses, sending funds to you when you want us to. We'll be the contact person for utility companies, for cleaners, for gardeners, building management companies, insurance companies, and so forth. So again, single point of contact for you, and we will be handling all of the third parties in Japan on your behalf.
In my case, as we've discussed in the past, my interest has always been Akia as a lifestyle choice. And like you, I have a Japanese wife, which makes the journey easier. But for someone without that advantage, you can't speak Japanese, is buying an Akia itself something you could help them with?
We can definitely help them with it, but we always ask them in advance if they know what they're getting into, because you've been exploring the topic for, you know, quite some time now, so you're fairly well educated. But a lot of the people who approach us for the first time approach us based on a dream or an article that they've read in some magazine or a show that they saw on the internet somewhere, where this, you know, there's this couple and they bought this property, $5,000 or $2,000, and they've turned it into a dream home in the Japanese countryside or running a successful Airbnb or whatever the case may be. Those dreams are all achievable, but there are a lot of obstacles on the way to getting there, right? If you're buying a very cheap property, it's going to need a huge amount of renovations. It's going to cost you several times the price of the property again in many cases. And the cheaper it is, the more likely that it, the cheaper and older it is, the more likely that is to be the case. In some cases, you find out in a structural inspection that the damage, you know, whether it's termites or tilting or sinking or the roof, like something is so in such a bad condition that it's not even worth fixing. And then you might be stuck with a property that, you know, would be cheaper to just demolish and rebuild a new property, but that wasn't within your budget that you've specified for yourself. You might be operating in a neighborhood where the community is not that welcoming to foreigners, whether from overseas or even from within Japan. I mean, there are some very rural communities that are not even welcoming to people from Tokyo, right? And there are a lot of shows and articles in Japanese media talking about this exact topic. You might be finding it very difficult to find local contractors to work with for various reasons. You might have not factored in the fact that, you know, yes, there's a bus running to and from somewhere nearby the property, but that bus only runs twice a day. There are a lot of things to look into when you're purchasing an Akia in the countryside. And the further away from the city and the cheaper it is, the more that becomes true. There are a lot of checkboxes that you want to tick. And there's a lot of practical discussions to have about what exactly you're planning to do with that property and how feasible that might be, that we would normally recommend to conduct before pulling the trigger on a purchase like that.
That's very good advice, because I've been finding that myself. Every time I find a place, I find there's some issue of many, many different issues. One or two will pop up. in each case that rules it out for me. So yeah, very good advice. I enjoy visiting different areas in Japan and looking at the Akiya. And once I decide on a place, as we've discussed in the past, Ziv, I'm going to get you to handle the paperwork and do the due diligence on it and all that kind of thing, right? Now, that's one of the services that Nippon Trading offers. But let's say, Ziv, that I don't want to go through the hassle of searching for a house and or an Akiya and get you to do all that for me. If so, what sort of costs are we looking at?
Well, our service would include research, but in the case of people who are buying like yourself for personal use of various sorts, you're always going to be the best filter, right? So the research that, because you can look at a few pictures, a floor layout, a map pin location, and immediately know if that property ticks your boxes or not. Look at the interior features, the exterior features, and you know if it appeals to you or not. With us, it's going to be a lot more of a hit and miss situation because we don't live in your head. We don't know what exactly appeals to you on a personal level. So it's usually going to be a mix of us holding your hand and showing you the websites that you can search on and how to translate them. AkiaMart, I'm not sure if people are familiar with that, is a very useful resource in English. It scrapes all of the major Japanese property websites and puts them in a Zillow-like map graphic format with filters, makes it very easy to search. So we would be guiding you on the tools and then helping you prioritize your short list and pointing out things that you may have not, might have missed when you looked at those listings initially. Then you'll be back to the drawing board and fine-tuning it. So we'll work with you. We can research everything for you, but again, that's going to be a lot more hit and miss. We're going to give you, 15, 20 properties, and you're going to say that, 90% of them don't actually gel with yourself or your wife for various reasons. So we would be more comfortable guiding you in research and then supporting you on the sidelines. The
Right.
cost for that is included in our fixed price. So if we're handling the entire purchase for you, that's a fixed price percentage of the property cost or the budget that you factored in. And then that would include the research, it would include the due diligence, it would include inquiries on, as many as 10 or 20 properties until we land on the one.
I'll make sure I put links in the description box to go to your site to, I think you've got all that on your site, the
Yes.
breakdown. Okay. That's great.
Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. AkiyaMart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily. Ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties, AkiyaMart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off AkiyaMart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akiya-mart.com. That's AKIYA-MART, akiya-mart.com, and kick off your search today.
I recently looked at condominiums up in Yusawa or Yusawa. And since the bubble burst back there in the 80s or 90s, condo prices dropped dramatically. I mean, we're talking like $5,000 to $10,000 US. And I've discussed in this video a bit earlier that the condominiums, at least in the snow country, didn't make much sense to me from an investment financial point of view, though they have lifestyle potential if you love skiing and that kind of thing. Now, you handle condos as well, I believe.
Yes, we do. We do. And the customers are buying in those areas, those extra cheap condos.
I wouldn't think they would be great from an investment point of view, but a lifestyle choice would be probably a good bet. Is that your experience, or you find that they're actually a good investment as well?
They're not a good investment simply because most of them are in resort locations.
Yes.
And resort owner unions are usually very, very much against rentals, right? So even long-term rentals, definitely monthly or short-term rentals, they might not be able to legally block you from renting out at least long-term or monthly, because that doesn't fall under short-term stay regulations. So they can't legally prohibit you from doing that, but they will be making life very difficult for your property manager and for your guests. So most property right. managers would not handle rentals in resort condominiums.
Okay.
If it's a standalone condo unit in a city, for example, you know, if you like to ski and you're buying a condo unit in Sapporo, just somewhere in the city, normal condo unit, that can be rented out similar to all other big Japanese cities. But if you're in more rural areas, even if you manage to find a condo that's not in a resort location, long-term rental would be your only option, because the owner union would again make life a bit difficult for monthly or short-term rentals.
Right.
Short-term rentals would not even be possible legally without their approval. And with long-term rentals, if it's a resort type of location where people only come for a few months of the year to ski, there's not going to be that big of a tenant base who will want to rent that out from you long term, right? I mean, aside from the winter tourism, those locations don't really have many people coming to them throughout the year. And definitely nobody living there out of season. So no, they don't make for the best investments, unless, again, you're buying an entire structure and repurposing it into a short-term stay hospitality property within city regulations, and you get your license. But that's running a business. It's not a passive or semi-passive property investment.
Sure. I'm very optimistic about the Japanese property market, but I don't want to give the impression that it's all rainbows and unicorns. What would you say are some of the dangers or downsides that buyers should be aware of?
Well, like we've mentioned with tenants, they're generally hassle-free from what we would expect from a Western perspective. So there's no deadbeats and drug labs. But Japan being Japan, it's got other issues. So the population decline here means that a lot of your tenants will be, again, semi-destitute pensioners, retirees, people that don't work anymore, are not in contact with their families at all, if they even have a family, and are generally, they could be living in the unit for, I don't know, 30, 40 years. Definitely, we have a lot of tenants who have been there for 10 and 20 years, and especially the men tend to be, unfortunately, very heavy smokers in many cases. They never open the windows. They don't want to deal with anyone outside of the property. So they're not going to contact the property manager when the wallpaper starts to peel or the mold begins to grow in the bathroom. And then when they move out or pass away, then you walk in there and it's a bit of a disaster, right? It's not a disaster because of any damage that they've done, but it's just neglect.
Sure.
You have hikikomori, like those, you know, social recluses who, again, even a younger crowd can just, you know, stay in the property, never leave, you know, do their entire life's business in there without once opening a window or a curtain. And obviously that takes its toll on the interior. When you're buying in buildings that are close to 40 years or older, that's when the building will start taking a lot more maintenance on a more regular basis. And building fees as a result will be escalating a lot more quickly once the building hits about 40 years. That obviously eats significantly into your yield and into your resale price as well, because those tiny units will be bought by investors and they're not going to buy it, you know, unless they reach a certain yield level. So your price tends to start falling off a cliff when they hit about 40 years of age. I mean, there's all kinds of little tips and tricks. I mean, you want to purchase a property that's within 10-minute walk to a subway or train, in some cities, maybe tram station. If it's a major station like Tokyo Station in Tokyo or Hakata Station in Fukuoka, then maybe 15 minutes is okay. But beyond that, it'll be hard to tenant. First floor units, especially ones that are, you know, easily viewable or accessible from the streets, are going to be shunned by single females. Yeah, I mean, again, it's something we can talk about for days and weeks on end. You know, buildings of five floors and less might not have an elevator. You want to look into that before you purchase a building, a unit on the fifth or fourth floor, because, again, Japan's population trend being what it is, a lot of your tenants are going to be elderly, and then they're not going to walk up four or five flights of stairs. Single moms with tons of shopping bags, same story, right? So the building's renovation history needs to be correlated with the, how much they've got in their reserve funds to make sure that they're not out of money and will need a big renovation soon, and that'll double the monthly fees again. I mean, endless. With a house, we've mentioned the structural inspections required, potential disputes with neighbors. If you're buying a very old house, it might have been constructed pre-zoning regulations. Part of the house might not be registered. There might be roads leading to the property that are actually owned by private property owners and not public roads. You want to make sure there's a memorandum in place allowing you to use, again, endless.
Endless. Okay, great info, Ziv. Now, as you know, the demographics in Japan is a bit of a problem, and it's predicted to decrease quite dramatically, the population diminishing over time. So I'm just wondering, you know, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but what's your feeling about the future of property investment or buying property in Japan?
Well, from our perspective, and it's been that way since definitely we got into business, and I'm sure before that, and I think that will continue for at least the next few decades. What the demographics are doing is that the local, smaller local villages and townships are conglomerating into the bigger cities. So if you look at the population from most of the big cities in Japan, they're all either stable or increasing in value, to increasing in population to various degrees. That is unlikely to change in the next few decades, regardless of what the government will do with increasing birth rates or immigration, if they will. So from my perspective as an investor, I never look more than 5 or 10 years ahead, because I'm not going to know what's going to happen. What I'm looking for is to get my capital back or close to it within a certain amount of time, and then reselling and looking at what to invest in next. So thinking beyond 10 years is going to be a bit difficult for me to estimate. In any case, I don't know what's going to happen macro and microeconomically. I would like to think that Japan's government will at some point wake up to the crisis and you know, start dealing with, you know, a more organized and larger immigration, or finally tackle the white elephant in the room, which is you know, women not being able to effectively work and have a family at the same time. I mean, the birth rates are basically families voting with their wombs, right? They're not feeling they're not feeling the ability to financially or you know, even lifestyle wise support having children, so they're not. I'm hoping the government will, I mean, I've had some hopes for the previous prime minister, but now, you know, when he finally got into position, his cabinet looked like the same old elderly penguins in suits. I didn't see too many women there, and now he's gone and there's a new, I don't know. I don't know if they'll wake up to the challenge or not, but I'm looking 10 or 20 years ahead, and the fundamentals of investing in particular locations in Japan during that period of time hasn't changed yet. If it will, we'll go all swell.
So I also want to point out that Ziv runs the Japan Real Estate Summit each year, and you can attend in person or online, I believe, Ziv.
Yes, that's correct. Twice a year, usually in April and October.
Okay. And I think you also run other events that you can sign up for and get your newsletter as well.
Yes, we do occasionally have little webinars, seminars. We do investor tours in various parts of the country that people can sign up for, or we can organize a private one for them. So anything related to real estate. And I've got another company, Nippon Bridge, that helps with other stuff. So people who are considering relocating to Japan, investing in businesses in Japan, we do a lot of that as well.
I think you're a great first choice, even though I'll be covering other people in the future. Mainly, I think that you're a good choice because you're quite easy to get along with, and your company's services are really comprehensive. People can take all or some of those services depending on their circumstances. For people watching, I highly recommend Ziv. I think you'd be happy for people to get in contact with you if they have questions or they're interested in using your services.
Yes, of course. We're always happy to talk shop. At the moment, we're a bit swamped. We haven't properly prepared for the growing pains that we're experiencing now. So we're in the midst of recruiting and hiring and training, and we're not going to be able to do the full purchase facilitation, single point of contact that we've just mentioned until early or mid next year. But what we have been doing is we've been putting people directly in touch with foreigner-friendly agents, and then we join in as consultants and hold their hand along the way. So the process is logistically identical. They just need to talk to one other third party, except just us.
Okay, well, if those full services will be available in the new year, that's great because it gives people more chance to actually do some background research before they get to you instead of coming in cold. And if even if
And
not.
we do love to talk shop. I mean, we love it even more if we can report the conversation because it brings value to other people as well on our Japan Real Estate podcast or YouTube channel. But regardless of that, even if we're not recording anything, we're always happy to talk shop. There's, I wouldn't say limitless, but we're very happy to have conversations and consultations and give people our two cents about properties they're looking at. So don't be shy to reach out.
Okay, great. To the people watching, I highly recommend Ziv and his company, Nippon Tradings International, if you want to get started in this market, whether it's a lifestyle choice or for investment opportunities. Ziv has your back. And so thank you very much for today, Ziv. I really appreciate it. There's some great information there, which I think will help people on their own journey to finding either an Akiya or an investment property in Japan. So I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you, and keep up the good work. Love what you're doing on the YouTube channel. I'm a big fan.
Oh, thank you. I'll keep it up. I'll keep it up. And hopefully I will one day get the Akiya that I'm searching for. We'll see.
Oh, we'll get there, I'm sure.
For sure.
Thanks for your time.
No worries. Thanks for that, Ziv.
Now, if you've attended any of our recent JREP Summit events in Tokyo or online, you've probably heard our sponsor, Robert Miller from Innovatius.com. He's been in web solutions here in Japan for the past 25 years, and he's also an active investor in Japanese real estate property, as well as global online property, which is his specialty and what his company Innovatius is all about. They offer a full suite of website services for entrepreneurs and small business owners, including all aspects of web design and management, backup and updates, content formatting and editing, proactive maintenance and error fixing, you name it, with a strong focus on SEO excellence, which is what gets you those hardcore top-of-the-list search engine rankings. But there is a difference. Innovatius works off a simple, all-inclusive monthly subscription model, as opposed to the typical outdated and confusing project model. So you never have to wonder how much any request for any work to be done on your website might cost. It's always $497 per month. And if that's not enough, if you've mentioned you've heard of their services on the Japan Real Estate podcast, you'll also get 10% off this monthly price for life. Also, and equally important, if not more, you can try out Innovatius for just 1 month, then switch them off, on again later if you want, and so forth. There are no minimum subscription terms. Now, if you're a small business owner, managing and growing a website is super distracting and time-consuming, right? That's exactly where Innovatius comes in. Robert's team takes care of all of that for you so that you can focus on what you do best. So feel free to email Rob on robert@innovatius.com, and his team will conduct a full SEO and website audit on your site, reveal anything that you should address to increase your website's appeal, and provide you with an easy-to-read detailed report with your own branding so that you can make some informed decisions on your online strategy and watch your business grow as you implement it. So once more, robert@innovatius.com. Drop him a line and get your website reviewed today. So there you have it. That was a pretty impressive range of topics we've covered there in a pretty short time, I thought. I hope it brought some value to you. Now, as mentioned at the start of the episode, I'm also attaching a shorter segment to finish things off. This one is more personal in nature and isn't really related to real estate, so you might want to skip it if it doesn't hold interest for you. It's an interview that I've given to a couple of very young and very enthusiastic international business students who are asking if they could interview me on the topic of doing business or working in a business in some of the environments that I've been immersed in over the decades. So mainly working in corporate environments in both Israel, where I was born and raised, then in Australia, and finally here in Japan, where I've been living and working for the past 12 years or so. So we discuss the differences in communication styles, decision making, project execution, time management, and a few other aspects that can be vastly different between these countries and business environments. So again, not really real estate related, but hopefully might hold some interest for some of you who like this sort of topic. Hope you enjoy this little segment as well.
Next, I would like to ask a question about the sense of time in Israel workplace. I heard how that many Israel have a right back personality, so much so that it's common practice to arrive late for a private meeting and things like that. But how is the actually the case in the work environment? So I would like to ask that What are your thoughts on tardiness and time flexibility in Israel workplace? From your perspective as a person living in Japan also, I will be happy to hear about the difference from the strict time management in Japan workplace.
Sure. So first of all, I'm not sure I'd use the word tardiness because, like you mentioned, in Israel, for example, people are very casual to each other, even in a work environment, even when talking to your boss.
Yeah.
But that's not considered rude. It's just the method that people communicate in. The communication is a lot more casual, but nobody is perceiving it as being rude because everybody speaks that way. Similar with the exact timing regarding meetings or exact deadlines or following exact agendas in preparation for a meeting. Israel is a lot more flexible in that way, but it's not necessarily perceived as tardiness because if everyone attending the meeting is expecting things to work in this way, then nobody is really feeling the other party is tardy.
Mm.
But working in a different environment, whether it's somewhere, I've lived in Australia in the past, for example, which was quite different in many ways, a little bit casual as well, but not as casual as Israel. And things that would have been considered normal in Israel would have been considered not polite in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And in Japan, it's even more strict than that. So compared to Japan, definitely arriving to a meeting, even exactly on time, is considered like the two of you logged into the Zoom room about 8 minutes before the conversation, right? This is very common for Japanese people to arrive somewhere ahead of the meeting and just wait outside until the right time arrives. So when we deal with foreign clients, whether they're from Israel or elsewhere, we often need to instruct them ahead of the meetings that arriving to a meeting late in Japan or arriving wearing clothes that are too casual or speaking in a certain volume or jumping into a conversation without the other party having finished, all of those things are considered rude in Japan. So mm-hmm. yes, there's a huge difference and that needs to be explained to people when they do cross-cultural business.
Okay. So then now, how do you manage your own time at work? I mean, how do you manage your work time yourself?
In what sense? I mean, I use a calendar and I put appointments on
it. Yeah,
something how do you
like
mean?
That.
Yes, I have a calendar. I have to put appointments on the calendar and I have to do my best to make it on time. Same as everybody else. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, yeah. Do you feel like you have a sense of more Japanese sense of time management or more Israel? More of Israel?
Definitely more Japanese these days.
Oh,
I've
really?
Lived here, yes, I've lived here for 12, 13 years here. And these days I get offended if somebody is late to a meeting as well. When I was working in Israel, I probably wouldn't have been.
I see. Thank you. So I found it very interesting to learn about the difference in barriers regarding time between Israel and Japan. Thank you for answering my question. So I'll
pleasure.
Give it to Aya next.
Good morning. Thank you
Good
very
morning.
Much for your time today. My name is Aya Naruke. My question is about how cultural backgrounds affect communication and leadership style in businesses. So I grew up both in Japan and Malaysia. I understand that you, Mr. Ziv, have worked in various cultures as well, including Japan, Israel, and Australia. I'm particularly interested in how Israel culture influences business practices. So today I like to focus on communication leadership in Israel business culture and ask you a few questions about it. Once again, thank you for your time. So let me start by asking about communication, as it's often mentioned all of the article that Israel communication tends to be frank and direct, that is opposite from Japan.
Mm-hmm. That's very true.
Okay, so how, looking at like about verbal communication, how do you balance verbal communication with non-verbal cues such as body language and eye contact?
Let's focus on Israel first. Eye contact is much more direct. It doesn't apply so much, I think, to work environments because in a work environment, even in Japan, people make direct eye contact. It's considered impolite in most cultures to not meet the eyes of the person you're speaking to directly. But in Israel, for example, you notice that even when you're walking down the street, everybody who's walking in front of you is making direct eye contact with you. In Japan, that's very rare. People immediately look to the side. They try to avoid making direct eye contact because it's considered rude to stare at someone. So that doesn't exist in Israel at all. Communication style. So Israelis do speak with their hands a lot. So we do use nonverbal communication, but in a very different way from Japan. I mean, we would use our hands or our gestures to emphasize things. In Japan, the hands and the gestures are sometimes used instead of speaking. So in Israel, for example, I say, yes, of course, and I'll wave my hands around. In Japan, somebody would try to indicate by lowering their eyes or tilting their head or doing something a lot more subtle, even without saying anything, they would try to indicate that something is challenging or interesting or not perceived well or perceived very well. It's a very different sort of communication style and hand gestures. Definitely, Israelis are a lot more vocal. So in Israeli culture, raising your tone as emphasis or lowering your tone in agreement is a lot more common than in Japan. In Japan, the verbal communication tends to be mellow in tone. There's a little bit of intonation in the end of sentences to indicate if it's a question or a statement. But there's not much intonation involved in the language. So yes, communication styles are very different.
Thank you. I felt like it's very more of like Italian culture. It's more,
yes,
like
very similar.
Yeah. So having worked in multiple culture, how do you feel Israel differs from other nations in terms of like communication styles, such as like not about verbal, but communication style?
So we've mentioned being direct and frank. Israelis don't tend to cushion their words. So if we're in a meeting, especially if you're feeling close to the people that you're meeting with, for example, a client that we've worked with for a very long time or people on our team, even if it's including our boss, Israelis would normally feel very comfortable to immediately respond with what they feel and think about something that somebody else said. So, for example, if somebody would say something, would float some idea and I had a criticism about it, I would normally feel comfortable to say, no, I don't think that's a good idea, because and the closer you are to the person, the more casual this communication gets. So if I'm very friendly with my teammates, I would say it's something like, no, what are you talking about? That would never work. That's a very normal way of communicating in a work meeting in Israel with people that you've been working with for a while and you're feeling comfortable with each other. Definitely not in Japan, but even in a lot of Western countries, that's considered very rude, right? Also, Israelis have a very direct sense of humor. They use cynicism and irony a lot, which even for Americans, which are a lot more casual than Japanese, that can come off as very offensive. The volume is also a lot higher, especially, again, when you're feeling close to people. I remember when I was living in Australia, I met a friend one day at the parking lot of a convenience store. And we were just having a chat about stuff related to our life, just personal stuff. And the way we spoke to each other was very normal Israeli volume, you know, like I was mentioning before. No, what are you talking about? You're stupid. Just a very casual conversation between friends. But we suddenly noticed that at the entrance to the convenience store, there were five or six Australians who were looking at us very concerned. They thought that maybe we're going to start hitting each other, maybe we're having a fight. For us, that's a very normal way of communicating, but it doesn't go down very well in the rest of the world.
Thank you. That is very different from Japan or Western culture.
Yes.
So the next question will be about decision making. When I was searching and learning about Israel culture, the article often said that Israel has like a quick decision making and see for the short term results from culture perspective. Is that true? If so, since you have worked in IT industry, how do you balance long term vision with short term results when managing large scale technology transition projects?
I think there's a bit of a misleading term then. It's not that culture, the work culture, is focused on short-term results. There's definitely long-term planning and thinking. It's just that on the way to get to that long-term goal, Israeli culture, and I think they're not the only one. Silicon Valley culture, for example, is very similar in the US. We're not concerned about trying many different things and seeing what works and then following one path. And if we see that that path is not leading to where we wanted to get, then we pivot and try another path. We're feeling very comfortable with more dynamic planning. So we have a general goal. Like, for example, I haven't been a fighter in the army, but I've listened to a podcast with people who are, and they've mentioned that when they're on a tactical mission, they have a goal, but they're very aware that the way to that goal will be very dynamic. So they think they have a rough idea of where they want to get. They try this way, it doesn't work. They have to quickly adjust to the situation, try a different way. So it's not necessarily the focus on short-term goals. It's more, we don't feel the need to have all of the details planned and documented and known in advance, because we're aware that as we progress towards the goal, things will change. So we're comfortable dealing with those changes as they happen and adjusting accordingly. What this leads to is, yes, quick decision-making and quick starting of projects, but then the deadlines can fluctuate a lot, right? So what we think would be the end goal can change a little bit. We will get there in a different way, which will take a longer amount of time, different amounts of resources. I think Japanese culture specifically, and I'm assuming other cultures as well, likes to have as much as possible mapped in advance. And what that usually leads to is that the planning and preparation phases will be a lot longer. But once the work starts, it will finish very quickly and exactly on the scheduled time. So it's a very much a different mentality, but I don't know that there's right or wrong here. I feel like we achieve our goals well enough in both cases. It's just the style of work is very different. It's more suitable for some people, less suitable for others.
Yeah, thank you so much. So in your view, how do Israel culture values shape long-term and short-term thinking and business strategy and project management? I'm very particularly interested in the role of leadership and culture factors in decision making.
That very much differs depending on who's leading the project. It's really hard to say grand. It's hard for me to generalize, because I've worked with leaders who were very, I don't know, North European or Japanese in nature, and I worked with these leaders who were very much Israeli in nature. Sometimes even extremely, even for my taste, extremely too much Israeli in nature. So it's very hard to answer that about the society as a whole, because different leadership styles make a big difference.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much. So the last question would be, how do you perceive culture difference when comparing decision-making in Israel to that of Japan, especially working closely with others?
I think this is where Japan is a little bit different to the rest of the world, because Israeli culture is similar, I think, to a lot of European and USA-based Western cultures, definitely similar to Australia, where I worked, where, generally speaking, I mean, occasionally you have a micromanaging boss, but generally speaking, leaders give their teams a lot more decision-making capacities and freedom to try things. Everyone is welcome to float ideas. Everybody will review the ideas together. There's not really any, I mean, there is obviously team meetings and decisions that are made as a team, and then decisions that a boss has to sign off or not, especially if there are budgets and resources involved. But generally speaking, it's not a group thinking kind of environment. Yes. So various people have ideas. You brainstorm with a lot of individuals. Yeah. Everybody has their own approach to solving the problem, and people discuss them together and make decisions together. In Japan, the cultural norms and the manners that people are thinking that they're required to have in a work environment are a lot more hierarchical and nuanced. So people tend to avoid, I guess there's a fear of making mistakes. So somehow, somewhere along the Japanese education system, students are taught that mistakes are a bad thing and they should avoid them at all costs. Whereas in more Western and Mediterranean, definitely cultures, we're being taught that making mistakes is one of the best ways to learn. So you try things, it doesn't work, you try something else. In Japan, if somebody has an idea and that idea is knocked down or not appreciated by other people, or if that idea is tried out and doesn't work, there's a concept of losing face, which is a very big issue, a very big embarrassment for a typical Japanese company employee. So they tend to avoid showing that they have ideas, or they tend to avoid voicing their ideas, or they tend to just wait and see what their superior is saying and then kind of agree with that automatically. That part of the work culture in Japan, I tend to disagree with. I think it's not very conducive to creativity or innovation. But again, it's very much a deeply entrenched educational thing. I don't think it can change in the workplace. I think it needs to change much earlier than that in early education year.
Yeah. So thank you so much. Israel is more of like individualistic and more Western style and open-minded style.
Open-minded in some aspects, not in all aspects, but in a working business environment, yes.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you so much. This is it for this interview. And thank you very much for your time and your answer today have been incredibly valuable, and we gained a lot of important perspective and very, very different cultures differences. So we will be sure to apply this knowledge in our future studies, business
communication.
Yes.
Glad thank to you have helped you.
Time. And
so there you have it. Now you probably know far more about me than you ever wanted to if you made it this far. Let me know your thoughts. And again, if you like what you hear and feel like it brought you some value, don't be shy to hop over to buymeacoffee.com/ZMAGEN and show your appreciation, but only if you're in the mood to do so. No hard feelings if you don't, of course. Thank you again for your support for the podcast throughout these last 7 years. And here's to a fantastic 2025 for all of us. Happy New Year. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa, and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.